Part V. Crucifixion and Resurrection. Jesus is crucified, pronounced dead, and placed in a sealed tomb. Later, the tomb is found empty, and the resurrected Jesus speaks to Mary Magdalene.
The Sabbath of the Passover was near. It was a day of much significance, beginning on the Friday just before the sun had set. And thus, although at times it took the crucified some days to die, in fact, the purpose of the punishment was to extend the agonies of death. On this occasion, Jewish minds were set to celebrate their freedom and recall the day that marked their special providence. The two who'd hung beside the Lord that day were both alive and looked as though they might survive for longer and would so pollute the Sabbath celebration now at hand. To hasten their removal and their deaths, the Jews requested that the legs of each be broken. This procedure, which was not unusual, deprived the crucified of any further chance of pressing up to snatch another breath. They died from lack of oxygen. Pilate agreed. And so the execution squad began their task. They broke the legs, as ordered, of the two transgressors who had hung there by his side. But when they came to Jesus, it appeared he was already dead. So, to make sure, a javelin thrust that made a fist-sized hole in his right side was deemed enough for all to claim their duty had been done. And John, the gospel writer, states with emphasis that he was there and saw the incident, and notes that blood and water freely flowed out of the womb. He does not say which side received the spear's thrust. This is assumed because a soldier's training taught him how to concentrate his aim upon the side left unprotected by his enemy's gripped shield. The Turin shroud confirms the wound, if you believe that to be genuine. Further, the physiology makes clear that Jesus was already dead before the soldier's final thrust was driven home. A soldier, a centurion he was, the exactor mortis, the very one in charge of staying with the crucified until the three were dead, had seen and heard all that had passed since noon upon that day. He was uniquely able to conclude that something very strange was happening. "Oh, certainly this man was innocent," he gasped. His claim was true. He was indeed the Son of God, and those who'd stayed to see the death throes on the gibbets moved away and beat their breasts in anguish and in fear. Joseph, a member of the Sanhedrin, a rich man of Judea, from a place we can no longer now identify, Arimathea was its name, was one of those whom Jesus had impressed. He was a man of courage and integrity. Careless of public reputation, he approached the governor and requested that the body of the Lord be given him. He would arrange a quiet burial. Pilate expressed surprise that he was dead. He knew that crucifixion could take days. When the centurion in charge confirmed that Jesus and the robbers were all dead, permission was soon granted. Perhaps now might be the time when we can best describe the tomb that Joseph had in mind to lay to rest the lifeless body of the man who'd so affected him. Joseph was rich. He'd had a new tomb dug out recently just for himself and for his family, a tomb that had been excavated from the rocky cliffside close to Golgotha. This was a fairly complex enterprise. Through solid rock, they'd made an opening as big as was required to walk inside to find two largish chambers hollowed out. The first a sort of vestibule, the next the tomb itself, which was some 6 feet long, but not as wide. Along one wall there was a kind of shelf with a substantial stone on which the body's head could rest. Outside, to protect the corpse from desecration by animals or men intent to rob, there was a very clever kind of door. A stone, shaped like a millstone or a wheel, ran down a sloping channel. It was large and heavy and was held in place by a wedge. A garden had been planted near the tomb, and through this garden Joseph and a friend named Nicodemus carried in the corpse. This Nicodemus was the man who came to talk to Jesus very late at night. But now he brought the customary myrrh and aloes, a mix of perfumed resin, both needed to complete the burial. The men had wrapped already the dead Christ in linen shrouds, but left much else to do. The obsequies remaining to be done was work which by long custom had become the women's privilege. There, standing close, as faithful to the Lord in death as they had been in life, were Mary Magdalene and Mary, wife of Zebedee, mother of James and John. They had begun their tasks, but must leave them unfinished, since the hour which marked the start of Sabbath intervened. The law prescribed that all work had to stop. A delegation led by Caiaphas, as soon as the restrictions of the law were satisfied, including Pharisees, approached the governor and put to him a problem they foresaw. They were afraid, in case the Lord's disciples should remove his body from the sepulchre and claim that he had risen from the dead, as once he said he would. For such a fraud would cause more problems then than if the man still lived. The so-called king had been quite lawfully and properly dispatched. His body now was lying in a tomb, and that was where they wished it to remain. They'd like a squad of soldiers to stand guard. Pilate agreed. They marched off to the sepulchre and fixed a seal. The job was done. Their cause had won. As dawn was breaking, Mary Magdalene and Mary, mother of the younger James, Salome too, also from Galilee, came dashing to the tomb. They'd work to do. They needed to complete what they'd begun. The Sabbath was now over. They would start. At least they hoped they could. They were not sure, because they knew they could not move the stone unless they had some help. They were surprised to find the entrance now agape. They paused, then went in quietly through the opening. They'd no idea at that time that the guards had felt the earth quake overnight and seen a figure white and bright as lightning single-handed roll back the stone and sit upon it. Traumatized, the guards all lay, subdued by panic and afraid to move. With just a glance, the women recognized the corpse had been removed. Without a word, the Magdalena rushed away to take this most distressing news to all the rest of those who'd followed Jesus since the days he first began to teach in Galilee. She found young John and Peter, and at once with anxious haste they ran ahead of her to see what they could make of this strange news. But John outran his elder and arrived to find that what the Magdalena said was true. Stooping and peering warily, he saw no corpse, but just the linen cloths which Joseph and which Nicodemus used. But true to form, Peter went straight inside, and there indeed were all the linen shrouds which Jews, by custom, used to clothe the dead. Only the napkin covering the head had been rolled up with care and placed elsewhere. Though John did not yet fully understand the import of the sight that met his eyes, a transcendental feeling stayed with him that lasted all his life. Peter and he, perplexed and mystified, both left for home. By this time, Mary Magdalene was back. She, Salome, and the other Mary went yet again to look inside the tomb, and there they saw, to their astonishment, two figures sitting on the ledge where once the body which they sought had been laid out. They were white-robed and shone as angels shine. "Why do you seek the living among the dead? Remember what he said to you one day while he was still in Galilee? I shall be made a prisoner and crucified, but on the third day I shall rise again." He has risen. What he foretold was true. You must go back and tell the 12 the news. Tell them that they will see him once again in Galilee. We are his messengers. It will be so. Go quickly. Tell them all. But Mary Magdalene remained behind and let the others do what they'd been asked. She was exhausted. She had spent her day thus far relaying messages. Perhaps she could anticipate the way the facts would be received with scorn and disbelief, for no mere women would be credited as bearers of such overwhelming news. And so she sat among the trees and flowers and wept as if her heart would break, until a man approached. She turned to look at him. He seemed concerned. "What are you crying for?" he asked. She thought the garden might be his. Perhaps he worked there, and perhaps he'd know where she might find the body that she sought. "Whom are you looking for?" he asked. "Jesus," she said. "His corpse was lying in a tomb here in the garden. Sir, I owed him much and came to treat his body with respect. You see, I've got myrrh and aloes here. If you have moved him, tell me where he is." But all he said, in her own dialect, with a familiar lilt she recognized, was, "Mary?" "Oh, Rabboni!" she exclaimed, and moved to hug the man she thought was dead. The Lord drew back. "Please do not touch me yet. My Father waits for me, and I must first ascend to him, to my God and to yours. They're the same. What you must do is go and tell my friends I'll see them very soon in Galilee." She had been right. She was not listened to. Hallucinations, women's talk, more proof of the essential weakness of her sex. Meanwhile, the tomb guards were recovering. Shamefaced, yet still astonished at the sight that had so frightened them, they went to seek the chief priests to report the happening and to explain how they had failed their duty. There was no doubting here, and hastily the Sanhedrin was called to contemplate how best to make sure that this incident was buried and not quickly spread abroad. The soldiers' palms were greased. They were to say that they had been asleep on guard and that the body had been stolen by his friends. They would square Pilate. Leave it all to them. This lie became the common currency.